Thomas Plume was born in Malden, a small market town in Essex, the younger son of a wealthy merchant. He went on to become Vicar of Greenwich and Archdeacon of Rochester. And by the end of his life, Plume was far wealthier than any contemporary archdeacon. He had accumulated over £6,000 in cash and stocks, various plots of land in Essex and Kent, six houses, a shop, and a castle. As part of his rather complicated and lengthy legacy, he left a library to the town of Malden, containing over 8,000 printed books and pamphlets, and nearly 500 handwritten notebooks and papers. My research focuses on these manuscript items and asks, why did Plume have them? How did he use them? And why did he leave them to his library to be, so as he says, carefully preserved? It should be emphasised that the manuscripts form a collection within a larger treasury of knowledge, the library and all of its contents. I'll say a few words about the library and the place of the manuscripts within it before discussing the type of documents Plume had and how he acquired them. I will then address some of the issues raised by the theme of this conference and will argue that there were three ways in which Plume may have seen the manuscript books and papers as a treasury of knowledge. First, in terms of their practical use for clergymen. Second, as testimonies to the times he lived through, which he had rescued from potential destruction. And third, as a form of memorial to the people he knew. Finally, I will highlight the practices which Plume shared with other contemporary manuscript owners and the ways in which his collection might be seen as unusual or problematic. Thomas Plume rebuilt the ruined medieval church of St. Peter during the late 1690s, repairing the tower and constructing a two-storey brick extension to house the town school on the ground floor and the library on the upper floor. He instructed his main executor, Dr. Francis Thompson, to arrange for the transfer of his books, paintings, and manuscripts to the library. Although he referred to the manuscripts as being of his own hand, they were in fact written by at least 30 different individuals. This raises the issue of ownership. Did Plume's annotations on these items encourage his executor to consider them as written by Plume, or did he simply view them as a complete body of papers to be kept together? Plume did not catalogue the manuscripts. In fact, the first catalogue was not created until the early 20th century. The lack of a catalogue creates a problem for the idea of a collection. How was anybody supposed to know what was there? My feeling is that Plume ran out of time, and though not explicitly stated in his will, left it to the librarian and executors to organise the books and manuscripts. The study of the said library, in Plume's will, where the manuscripts were to be preserved, could have referred either to a cupboard or a space or chamber within the library room, since both terms were in use at the time. The unbound papers were rediscovered in an old chest in the early 20th century and reviewed in an article by Dr. Andrew Clark, but there's no reference to the post-Plume archives in the post-Plume archives of where the notebooks and papers were kept before that. The loose papers were gathered together in bundles labelled through bundles A to I by Dr. Clark, and it's likely that he found them in these groupings. During the 17th century, the separation of printed and manuscript books on library shelves was becoming increasingly common, but it appears that by the time of the arrangement of Plume's library, four distinctions were made between material forms of text: printed books, unbound pamphlets, handwritten books, and unbound papers. This is probably less relevant to how Plume thought of them, though, and more to do with the actions of those who arranged the contents. This slide and the next show some of the material forms taken by the handwritten texts. Here you can see hardbound books and those with limp vellum covers. And on this slide, papers sewn together or secured with a metal pin and single loose leaves or fragments. In terms of genre or content, there are six main types. The first type is sermon-related, and this applies to around three-quarters of all the manuscripts. These notebooks and papers include sermons heard by the scribe, as well as sermons drafted for preaching, and in some cases for publishing. The second type of document is notes from reading, either a series of readings made over a number of years, grouped together in a notebook or reading diary, or notes made from a single book on loose paper. The third type is notebooks of commonplaces under headings, or notebooks containing stories or anecdotes. The fourth type includes treatises or expositions, for example, a scribal copy of one of Lancelot Andrews' manuscripts on the form of church governments. The fifth type is miscellanies of mixed content, reading notes, sermons, copies of letters sent, and poetry, all within one notebook. And the final type is household and accounts, including a recipe for brewing and Thomas Plume's ale bill. In case you were wondering, he had a firkin of ale every month, which is equivalent to 9 gallons or 41 litres. These everyday household items cause problems for the idea of a treasury, though. We might find them interesting in the present day, but at the time Plume left the papers to be preserved, surely he did not consider them to have a place next to useful knowledge and memorial items. Thomas Plume acquired the manuscripts written by other people, either through gifts from friends or buying them second hand. He placed these acquisitions alongside his own writings and those started by family members. The first example is a miscellany of notes from different types of sources. You can make out the name John Plume and the date 1636 on the cover of this notebook. There were at least 5 individuals named John Plume in Thomas's family tree, but the most likely is the one who died during the year the book was started, half-brother to Thomas and a few years older. John's work is concerned with arithmetic and calculations. On the first page, John wrote that the table pictured serves to reckon any number, and there are a few further pages on the addition of money and weights. Thomas Plume started making use of John's notebook 2 years into his time at university. He continued using this notebook for arithmetic, and you can see the calculations for amounts of rye, wheat, barley and oats. That's sort of in the middle of the page there. Bushels of rye, it starts with. At a later date, Plume wrote in his notebook again, recording his reading of Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy. Plume owned the 1654 edition of Descartes' Meditations, printed in Amsterdam. The inscription says the purchase price was 6 shillings and 2 pence, and has been amended, perhaps to show the price that Plume paid for it. There is an inscription on the front page down of Descartes' Meditations reading, Thomas Knight, 8th of October 1659, and on the back page down, 15th of October 1660, presumably when Knight finished reading it himself. Thomas Plume did not always ascribe a date to his own readings, but the last date found in John Plume's notebook is 1688, showing that Thomas had used the notebook for 40 years, and on his death it had been in the family for at least 68 years. This illustrates how Thomas Plume continuously valued the notebook during his lifetime as a practical resource. A combination of evidence from wills and the dating of manuscripts can show how the ownership of books transferred to Plume from the clergymen Edward Hyde and Robert Borman. After disposing of his printed books to various family members, Edward Hyde, who is first cousin to Lord Clarendon of the same name, left Robert Borman in his will what he described as his paper books. Slips of paper in Borman's hand, inserted between the pages of Hyde's notebooks, shows that he definitely read them. Plume also made annotations in both Hyde's books and Borman's, and this demonstrates that these clergymen read, valued, and were perhaps influenced by each other's work. Robert Borman subsequently published a treatise and collection of sermons originally authored by Hyde, which represented a memorial to his friend, as well as being a vehicle for Borman's own quest for patronage. The next example is an account book started by Robert Borman on his presentation to the Rectory of St Giles in the Fields. This document is useful because it can pin down exactly when Borman last used it, and this provides a small time frame from when Thomas Bloom could have acquired it. The last entry in Borman's account book is the 5th to the 12th of October 1675, and you could just make that out at the very bottom. There's a shadow there, probably my thumb. After that, Borman presumably became too ill to continue as rector, since he died 1 month later in Greenwich, where Plume was vicar. In his will, Borman describes Plume as one of his very loving friends and left him £5 to buy a morning gown. Borman's will does not mention his personal library of printed books or manuscripts, but does say that he had discussed with his brother how to dispose of any possessions not mentioned in his will. This means that Borman must have either given Plume his manuscripts in the month before his death, or his brother passed them on to Plume afterwards. The final example of how Plume acquired his manuscripts is through second-hand purchase. It is likely that Plume bought manuscript books second-hand in the same way that he bought printed books, as we've seen in the example of the book previously owned by Thomas Knight. One example of a notebook that changed hands for money was once owned by Robert Lovelace. There is no apparent connection between Robert Lovelace and Thomas Plume. Lovelace was vicar in Hertfordshire and died in 1673. No will has been traced, so it's possible that Plume bought the notebook in a sale after his death. The evidence that the book had been purchased by someone is in the inscription on the title page in Lovelace's hand. It reads, "Robertus Lovelace, price 15 pence. Nothing will be received with sadness. In all this book, there seems nothing considerable or legible but speeches and recent thinking. The rest seems to be notes taken from Dr. Bailey as they were preaching." Therefore, Lovelace may have bought or sold the book for 15 pence. It could be argued that Plume was interested in the content relating to Dr. Bailey's preaching, since he owned a printed book of sermons by Dr. John Bailey, as well as several other examples of sermon transcription. It seems, therefore, that there was some sort of rationale to Plume's collection. Plume was proactive in seeking out useful information and items he wanted to save for posterity through buying them second-hand. The collection was not simply evolving through the passive acceptance of gifts of books and papers, which he kept with his own work. How then did Plume see the manuscripts as a treasury of knowledge? First, they served him and their original authors as a useful repository of information. For example, the same sermon, once written up and preached, could be reused in another parish. One clergyman's work could be appropriated and expanded by another. Reading notes could be revisited at a later date, and indexes could be inserted into notebooks to easily retrieve information. Plume had acquired two notebooks which had once belonged to Robert Joyner. Joyner's notebooks contain records of the sermons he preached in Somerset and London. He annotated one of the entries to show that he preached that sermon on several occasions, in London at St Paul's, Temple, St Mary's, Lincoln's Inn and Plumstead, and in Somerset in Chew Magna and Dundry. Plume also referred to Robert Joyner's notebook, as can be seen by the slip of paper in his writing, found between the pages. It's on this side here. Although the page marker does not give any commentary on what Plume has read, he has marked this page for a reason. He wanted to refer back to Joyner's text because it would help him in some way. In the unbound notebook on this slide, one scribe uses work created by an earlier writer in order to adapt the sermon for his own purposes. Scribe 2's appropriation of the text can be seen clearly, where he provides a link from Scribe 1's sermon to his own editions on the next page. Scribe 2 has written, "Job hath left few," at the end of Scribe 1's text, and continues the sermon at the top of the next page, so he can preach it as a continuous work. Note the catchword "few" at the top of the page. This recycling of sermon notes demonstrates the ways in which practical use could be made of work already created by another. However, there's very little evidence of annotation on the manuscripts after they were put into the library. This could be explained by the fact that they had now become institutional property. We might hypothesise that a reader would be less likely to write in a book belonging to a library than one they personally owned. The second way in which Plume saw his collection as a treasury was as a safeguard for fragile and impermanent pieces of knowledge. In the same way that many monastery collections were dispersed during the Reformation in England, writings by clergymen of the established church were in danger of destruction by parliamentarian forces during the Civil War and Interregnum. Plume's mentor, John Hackett, for example, lost many books and papers when he was sequestered from his living in Holborn. In Plume's Life of Hackett, which prefaced his publication of Hackett's Sermons, he records that Hackett had always meant to write a biography of James I. Plume relays that Hackett had been given William Camden's manuscript notes of James's reign, together with John St. Armand's, quote, many choice letters and secrets of state of his own collection. However, because many of these unique and valuable items had been lost, and Plume says the melancholy rust of the Civil War had eaten into Hackett's soul, Hackett had been unable to complete the work. Another reason that Plume may have saved other people's manuscripts was that it enabled something of their life and essence, their scholarship, to be preserved as a continuing memorial to them. This desire for a lasting remembrance may have also come from the person giving the documents and could have stood in lieu of a biography or publication in print of their work. The fact that Plume saved Robert Borman's account book alongside the more useful sermon notes and treatises could have meant that Plume wished to preserve the whole body of work Borman created during his career. The work then served as an exemplification of Borman's life after his death. So how does Plume measure against other 17th century manuscript collectors? He shared practices with contemporary scientists and historians in that he used manuscripts to mine them for information which he could use to perform his professional role. For example, Samuel Hartlieb collected Francis Bacon's papers and other scientific and philosophical manuscripts, which could be used in the same way as contemporary printed books. Like other collectors, Plume also proactively saved items for posterity. One of the major early 17th century collectors of manuscripts was Sir Robert Cotton. Francis Bacon called Cotton a worthy preserver and treasury of rare antiquities. This reflects the way in which Cotton saved these items to prevent their potential loss to the world and future scholars. Although the type of documents Plume saved were very different, being working papers rather than finished texts, it could be argued that Plume was saving them for the same reason. The major way in which Plume's practice differed to that of other collectors is that he did not catalogue his items. The only evidence for any sort of ordering is in the marking of indexes in some of the notebooks. Another way in which he differed is that he did not bind items together in order to preserve them better, for example, as did Robert Cotton or Samuel Pepys. Finally, there's the issue of the household items being kept with the other documents, since they are neither useful to future scholars nor form a memorial. They should have been discarded by Plume or by Dr. Thompson or given to the executors administering the state. The only explanation for their presence is that Francis Thompson scooped up all of the manuscripts he could find, discarding nothing, and thus setting an eclectic tone for Thomas Plume's manuscript Treasury of Knowledge. Thank you.